Every life transformed by medicine is a story. One that often begins with an investigator with a fresh idea. An idea that turns into a study and that ultimately advances patient care. Only innovation can truly help our patients live longer, healthier lives. Hello, my name is Dr. Kira O'Sullivan, and I'm a breast medical oncologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. This is the monthly podcast of ACRU, the Cancer Research Network, whose mission is to establish the next level study for cancer research across the major disease groups. In this podcast, we want to hear the stories behind the innovative ideas and listen to the unique journeys of our researchers. Listen in as we explore the people and ideas of today's leading translational research.
Welcome to the ACRU Transformative Research Podcast. My name is Dr. Kira O'Sullivan, and I'm excited to host this episode as we explore the stories and innovation of today's leading translational research. So our special guest today is Dr. Jian Campion. Dr. Campion has both an MD and a PhD. She's a medical neuro-oncologist with a long-standing interest in developing novel immunotherapeutic approaches to treat brain tumors. She is a principal investigator or co-investigator of numerous clinical trials involving primary brain tumors and metastatic brain tumors. She has led pioneering translational and clinical research to boost innate immunity and promote immune reconstitution. Dr. Campion is also a pioneer in applying chronotherapy-based interventions in cancer. As a translational and clinical physician scientist, Dr. Campion has been active and successful in developing and executing multiple investigator-initiated early phase clinical trials in central nervous system cancers. Her long-term research goal is to successfully treat solid tumors with cytokine and other immunotherapeutic approaches, and also helps to develop novel therapeutic approaches to treat gliomas, with a special focus on individualized treatment and correcting treatment-related lymphopenia. Fortunately for us, she recently joined the Mayo Clinic faculty and serves as Associate Medical Director of the Cancer Clinical Trials Office at the Mayo Clinic Comprehensive Cancer Center. She's been very active and successful in developing and executing investigator-initiated clinical trials and collaborating within the industry. She now brings her expertise to the ACRU with a specific focus on CNS malignancies to help develop novel approaches to meet patients' needs. She is also a member of our ACRU Executive Committee, where she is a key player in setting the vision and strategy for ACRU as we aspire to improve the lives of our patients with innovative clinical trials. Dr. Campion, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to be here to talk to people. As you know, I have a new study right now going through development with ACRU staff. The study development has been going through very smoothly. So we're hoping we can get the study open in the third quarter of this year.
We'd love to hear all about you and how you came to be where you are right now.
At the beginning, when I was kind of young, I didn't think I would become a cancer doctor, especially for brain cancer doctor. I knew I was interested in medicine when I was little because my grandpa died from lung cancer, but he was a heavy smoker. But I didn't know what a doctor really means. Eventually, I got to medical school, but after graduation, actually, I decided to do more study, do research. I studied actually pharmacology and toxicology. So that time, I did a lot of bench research. I was really enjoying it. I like to do all the pipetting and the southern blot, western blot, or handle animals, make a transgenic construct and transgenic mouse line. So I thought that was all very interesting. But it's during the time I was in my PhD, I had two colleagues. So one developed lung cancer, one developed neuroblastoma. And actually, that time I was doing research in lung cancer, but I felt what I was doing was too far to be helpful. So that made me realize, you know, in order to make difference or make an advance faster, I should get back to clinical medicine. So as you know, I had a PhD in pharmacology. That's before I started residency. I realized I need to go back, start residency in internal medicine. you know, when I got into internal medicine, I wasn't certain if I want to be cancer doctor because all my research was for lung injury and some part lung cancer. So at the beginning, I was thinking about becoming a pulmonologist, especially when I worked in ICU. I like the achievement you can save a life when you give the right treatment. But things changed after you meet really the critical people. So yeah. I have a question regarding who really influenced your decision, your career path. I thought I was so fortunate to get chance working with many very great people, great mind in this field. So during residency, I got chance work with Dr. Kanti Roy. You know the right criteria?
Oh, wow. Okay. From like leukemia, right? CLL, that right, Dr. Roy?
He had the first CLL criteria classification. It's called the Roy criteria, Roy classification. So I got to work with him and then he asked me to go to his clinic. So I had a chance to work with him very closely every weekly and I got to see patients. And actually, I wrote my first cancer-related paper with him. It is a review for CLL treatment. So that got me interested. But still, that time I was only like knowing lymphoma or leukemia or some lung cancer, but never see brain cancer patients. But because of Dr. Roy, I want to be a cancer doctor. So I applied the Hem/Onc fellowship. I got into Johns Hopkins. When I got there, my plan was either lymphoma or lung cancer doctor. So I got to work with different attendings. So the first year, I was really thinking about different route. But during my inpatient rotation, first year, we're heavily loaded with clinical work. We had, at least at that time, many years ago at Hopkins, we had 10 months in floor and 4 months in solid tumor floor. So I got to see many patients. It's again, probably just by chance, many of the patients I encountered were brain tumor patients. And at that time, the brain tumor patients' treatment was mainly surgery. After surgery was radiation and temozolomide was kind of just, start to be available. We are using it, but we also had a patient just kind of radiation. And I saw patients came in with PCP infection, which is not common in average people, right? Normally you see PCP infection in AIDS population. So that actually led to a study at Hopkins. People found those patients who came in the hospital with brain tumor after chemoradiation, they had a lot of PCP reaction. Infection, and we found their immune cells are really low. So I got very interested in that. So we did more studies, follow up. There's another large prospect study from American Brain Tumor Consortium. They led a multi-center study for over 100 patients. They monitored those patients' lymphocyte number and CD4 count over time from baseline until a year during the treatment course. What they found was patients started with normal lymphocyte number, especially normal CD4 count, but with a week passing by, the standard treatment is 6 weeks of chemoradiation. Every week passing by, you see their lymphocyte count and the CD4 count dropped every week. It's really very steady.
When would you say you felt, oh my goodness, this is what I'm going to do. Brain cancer is what I'm going to focus on. Was this something that occurred during your clinical first? Did it happen a bit later?
So actually, in my first year, I was still debating. But after I see so many brain tumor patients, I felt somebody need to help them because there are really no good treatment. One line therapy. There are really no second line therapy. But those patients are really good citizens. We feel they are the one really taking care of themselves, go to gym, eating healthy, don't smoke, don't drink. But they only have a brain tumor. For that, I feel that those people deserve better therapy, but we just don't have. Many people, including myself, at the beginning, I was afraid of brain cancer, right?
I think a lot of people are, right? I think it's just one of those things. You hear brain metastasis, brain cancer. It's like the end, quote unquote, even though it shouldn't be, right?
Yes. So yeah, really dealing with something in the brain is really feel, this is too hard. So it took me a while to really decide to become a neuro-oncologist. One thing, because I encounter so many patients, that's built up my kind of feel, more comfortable. Another thing, there's another key person I encountered during my training is Dr. Scott Grossman. He is one of the most senior medical neuro-oncologists, I think, in the country. He really got me interested in CNS malignancy. He told me, there is just another cancer. Learning how to read a scan, learning how to do the neurologic exam is not hard. You just need to keep doing it. So that's what I did. So at the end of first year, I decided to give a try. Even I was still not decided. It took me another year to be finally decided that's what I want to be for my career.
And so would you say there were any specific, again, confidentiality and everything, but any specific patient encounters or patients that left a mark in you that made you think, oh gosh, okay, this is what I'm going to do? Obviously, you've described the value of mentorship and how interacting with somebody who's enthusiastic and passionate about their career can rub off in you. Was it more the patient side, the research side, a mixture of everything that kind of contributed to your decision to pursue neuro-oncology, would you say?
I think it's both from patient side, also from my own experience and the mentor support. I really encountered quite a few very, very, very pleasant patients. They were, I remember one of the lady I saw, unfortunately she passed away already. She was really taking care of herself, and then she also tried to help others. She kind of like helping people in Africa. She used to make a donation, helping kids for education. So she was really great human being. Yeah. And she was in good shape when she saw us, but no, she had a glioblastoma. We tried what we could, but we really didn't have good treatment. So unfortunately, she passed away just under 2 years. We first saw her, she was doing yoga every day. So that made me feel so bad. I really feel we need to help those patients. Another thing from my own kind of experience. So, during fellowship, you have multiple projects. So I had a project in lung cancer. I had a project in brain tumor. And my brain tumor project worked out. So that's another way.
Destiny is pointing you in the right area. And then obviously this is an accrue podcast, and I know you've been involved in numerous clinical trials through accrue. And I'm excited, as I'm sure our listeners are, to hear about your current study, which I believe is in development via the accrue. Can you tell us a bit about that?
So actually the study right now under accrue development is a follow-up study from my previous single phase 2 study in patients with recurrent glioblastoma. As we all know, there are really not a lot of effective good treatment for patients with glioblastoma. We have a upfront frontline therapy, but after that, once tumor comes back, there are really no good therapy available. So in the field, there are a lot of clinical research going on for patients who develop progressive and recurrent glioblastoma. But most studies exclude patients received bevacizumab because after bevacizumab, patients tend to do worse, and MRI is hard to interpret. There are a lot of special challenges. For a long time, actually, before I developed this study under through accrue, back to my initial study, which I did at WashU, at that time, I was looking for access for patients. We know checkpoint inhibitor like anti-PD-1 antibody had shown great promise in many tumor types, but in brain tumor is still unknown. It was not easy, at least at that time, it was not easy to get access. So I want to find a way for our patient to get access. Additionally, radiation therapy is not standard at the second line, but we know their responses when you give correctly. Still, this is still kind of a debate area. So when looking for early studies, we also found there are some promising results from other centers when they did a phase 1 study combining hypofractional radiation with anti-PD-1 antibody.
And so what is the design of your current study then? What is the study design, or what are you looking at?
So the current study design is based on my previous study. The previous study is designed as a single arm because for brain tumor, patients are hard to really do control. Every patient, they can't do control because the tumor is so aggressive. Sure. So previous single-arm study is a hypofractional radiation with anti-PD-1 antibody retifanlimab because the repeated radiation could also cause cerebral edema. So we allow the bevacizumab to be used prevent cerebral edema, also prevent radiation necrosis, and spare patients from the use of high-dose steroid, because steroid and anti-PD-1 antibody may not agree with each other. So that was a single-arm study. We actually completed accrual very quickly, 1.5 years, and we had data presented just last November. That single-arm study is a positive study. We're writing up manuscript. So based on that study, a sponsor Insight, they are very interested to proceed. The next study, which you really want to confirm efficacy, when you want to do that, you need a randomization. Because single-arm study compared with under control, you know, they're biased, right? So that's the study for the current accrual study. It's a follow-up from my previous study. Now it's a randomized open-label phase 2 study in patients with recurrent glioblastoma. One key thing I want to mention is this study actually has very broad eligibility, allow any, like everyone, because I always want to study really provide patient access, you know, especially in rural area, in the underserved population minority. So I want to make it simple, easy, and really work for general population, not a cherry pick.
I think that's so important, right? We want like easy, accessible trials that can, you know, reach beyond the major academic centers and involve a lot of great community sites as well. So that is awesome that you're designing something so broad. That's fantastic.
Thank you. And this study, really, the eligibility criteria is very broad, almost like anyone can participate as long as they can receive radiation. And we also allow bevacizumab, which is standard care drug, can be given locally. The study drug has to come to accrual site to receive a study drug, which is a standard requirement. And the study randomization, there are two arm, 1-to-1 randomization. The experimental arm is hypofraction radiation, is 3.5 gray for 10 treatment, basically 2 weeks treatment. And then they will receive retifanlimab, is anti-PD-1 antibody, along with bevacizumab, which is anti-VEGF antibody. They will receive first cycle 2 weeks before radiation. After 2 weeks radiation, so by week 4, they can get second cycle for bevacizumab and retifanlimab. So the study is every 28 days at the cycle. If a patient can tolerate and have a response, they can keep going for up to 2 years.
Wow, that's amazing.
There's a control arm. That's how we can confirm efficacy. Yep. The control arm is everything similar, just without retifanlimab. So patient will receive hypofraction radiation, same type of radiation, 3.5 gray for 10 fractions with bevacizumab.
And what's interesting about the compound, the checkpoint inhibitor compound, in terms of, did you see some exciting preclinical data or anything you can share from the clinical phase 1 that excited you about this treatment approach?
Actually, we saw in the single arm phase 2 this combination showed improved overall survival. And the main thing what is most impressive is, actually, when we talk about survival, it sometimes can be misleading, because in GBM field, like temozolomide was approved just by improving survival by 10 weeks. So 10 weeks is significant in our world, right?
Yeah, incremental benefit, right?
But the temozolomide really is very effective drug, save a lot of lives. So when we did our study, when we just look at the median overall survival, the improvement is 2.5 months. It's just similar like temozolomide. But what is striking is response rate. Normally, we don't really see response. Like a stable disease is as good as we can get. Even just stable disease, we're very happy. But in our study, the early single-arm phase 2 study, we found 62.5% had a response.
Oh, gosh, that's a really high response rate. That's really exciting.
I know. And also durable response. If they only respond for 2 months, maybe doesn't mean too much. We had 40% of patients had durable response more than 6 months.
Wow. And this is recurrence, right? So that is very promising. Pardon. And how many patients will you be enrolling, and how many sites are you hoping to open this study at across the accrual? Do you know that yet?
This is right now is a phase 2 study. We are planning to accrue total 134 patients. We plan to have 8 to 10 sites at a crew. So here I want to give another shout out for crew.
All for shout outs.
Because for our patients, we are not like taking care for breast cancer. They're like thousand patients. GBM patient, like the case every year in US is about 12,000 new cases a year, right? Whenever you do a study, like more than 50 participants, you need a multi-center. So, but we don't need 100 sites because this has broad eligibility. Most patients eligible, but still you need a multiple size, like 8 to 10 will be the perfect size. So I was very excited when I found accrual can conduct this study. Because the accrual has both academic and community place. And for this study, same thing, we can easily get a patient from academic large center, but because the easy design, patient from rural area, from community clinic can join the study as well. And the management and the really professional conduct of the study from accrual is a huge support for us.
I mean, I think this is going to be great, and I hope we get to open this at Mayo as well. I'm really excited for patients regarding this study. So just in general, Dr. Campion, you're obviously an expert as it relates to neuro-oncology and immunotherapy. How do you see the field evolving over the next 5 to 10 years as it relates to treatment of CNS malignancies and brain metastases? And how do you think clinical trials will change, or how will we make further progress in your area, do you think, based on your expertise?
I think, first of all, we have to do research. That's how we knowledge, or that's how we get to where we are, right? But looking back, just think about the lung cancer, because I wanted to be lung cancer doctor earlier, so I followed lung cancer a little bit more closer than other tumor types. When I was in fellowship, I know the data we got was 5% survival at five years.
Yeah.
But now the number is almost 10 times better, right?
It's amazing. It's been just so shocking, like the advances. I feel like every week a new FDA approval pops up for lung, some sort of subtype.
That's really why we are in academic center. If we just want to treat patients, we can go anywhere. But we really want to make a difference. We want to save lives, not just for the patient in front of us. We want to save lives for thousands of people with this cancer condition. So for GBM, this is a tough one, I have to say. I pick up a tough tumor. There are a lot of special challenges. Blood-brain barrier and the location, the patient performance status. There are just really many challenges. It's hard to pinpoint one. But still, there are no other shortcuts. We just have to keep working on it. You just have to keep doing research. I can't be biased in the selection of the research, because I'm interested in immunotherapy. That's how I started my career. I really, truly believe immunotherapy could have a role in glioblastoma or in brain tumor in general, including brain mets. The reason is, for the last 50 years, we have tried almost everything. We started with surgery, right? And different type of surgeries have been tried. There are the gross total resection, subtotal resection, biopsy, laser ablation, or the awake, or all different techniques. We know different therapy or different kind of surgery can give you different prognosis, but that's only incremental changes. Later on, radiation was available, but radiation is not for cure, not even for long-term control. Also, it's more like a localized therapy. Nowadays, we learned glioma, especially glioblastoma, is more like systemic disease. It's a diffuse tumor to begin with. So what we need is really systemic therapy. Now, we have tried multiple type of cancer, cytotoxic chemotherapy drugs. So far, after 100 attempts, the only one showed activity is temozolomide. There are a few older drugs like lamastin, camastin have some activity, but is not too good, basically.
I think the fact that you really point that out, right, that it's hard work, there's no shortcuts, but I think, obviously, as a field, oncology, clinical practice and research can be challenging. Advances are sometimes a lot slower than we would like. So I think this is my opinion. I think it takes a special kind of person to do something like neuro-oncology. What are your thoughts on that? How do you keep yourself motivated sometimes when maybe clinical progress, research progress is slower than we would like? And also, what would you say to a young trainee thinking they may want to pursue a career in neuro-oncology? What are the things that keep you going, and how do you stay inspired, and how would you inspire others?
Sometimes I also even ask myself, and my kids ask me too, especially when you're seeing a patient in your clinic, you know, unfortunately, most of them will not make more than 2 years. It is heartbreaking when you see a patient. Because after a while, you develop a relationship with the patients. Yeah. When you see someone, you know, they're fighting for their lives, and we want to help them, but we just don't have the tools to help them. So it's not easy, I have to say. But, you know, I think that's how we make an advance. You just have to stay on course. Just keep doing. My mentor from Hopkins, Dr. Grossman, what he told me, I asked him, how can I be successful in academia? He told me persistence. Of course, for young people who are choosing their career, I think you need to find something you like, you really enjoy. You feel a sense of satisfaction. You feel you can achieve something. It may not be big, but at least daily basis, you're doing something you feel is meaningful. Yeah. You feel you can help people. Maybe not too much in short run, but any contribution, even the negative study, we learn, right? Then you learn, if you learn something, you should not do this way, you should do other way. So everything you learn, all this knowledge built on a lot of experience, it can be positive experience, can be successful. A story, it can be negative or unsuccessful story, but all this build up our knowledge.
Yeah, and I think you raised a really good point about having purpose and meaning in what you're doing. And I can see that you are full of purpose when it relates to your field, which is really wonderful. And have there been any moments, any standout moments in your career, professionally or personally, that have made you think, okay, this is worth it? Where I'm meant to be, I'm making that difference that matters to me. Can you tell me a little bit more about kind of wins for you personally and professionally?
Luckily, I do have quite a few good stories to share. And also, you know, most of my really good stories are from clinical research. So I had several studies. You know, I kept doing clinical research for all these years, right? And I had patients really lived much longer against the odds. So there was another study, also immunotherapy, but a different approach, right? Different combination. When we started the study, it was phase one and phase zero. I didn't honestly have high hope. I was just thinking, okay, at least another approach people can do, because we didn't really have anything else available. So I remember when, at that time was still phase one. So if a patient comes to phase one, basically they felt they have no other options. That's the kind of last resort, at least at that time. So I remember one lady was really not too old, like early 50, purely had a multiple recurrent GBM. And her local doctor talked to her into hospice. So she, right before she was deciding, like, you know, getting to hospice, she came to my clinic looking for options. She was in wheelchair and she really was not very responsive. It was her performance status really quite poor. But her sister, she had very dedicated support. Three sisters came with her and really looking for options. They say they want to give another try. It doesn't matter what drug it was. They want try one more time before send her to hospice. So that time we had one slot open for that phase one study, because phase one always have slot open, the next cohort. So we're just lucky, we're looking for one participant. For her, you know, she was not really fitting that, no, her performance status wasn't low, but luckily it was a phase one study. So we were kind of very broad eligibility. So we let her on, but even that time I kind of talked to her sister, we're saying, you know, we're not sure this can really help or not, but, you know, if we really want to try, that's one option. So we did.
And what happened?
She was getting more and more awake, more responsive.
Oh, wow.
6 months later, she was able, not really walk by herself, but she was able to walk with walker. And then when I saw her a year later, she was able to walk. In Christmas time, she made a Christmas cookie. She brought a big box.
Oh, my God. That's incredible. Yeah.
It was crazy.
Things like that are just when you realize that, you know, you've personally given somebody an extra couple of years with their family. It's not a huge thing.
She went up study for 5+ years. She only passed away.
5+ years. Oh my gosh.
She passed away at around year 6.
Wow.
With recurrent glioblastoma.
These are the stories that we need to hear, and I'm sure the stories that keep you going. So, Dr. Campion, we'd like to end our podcast with a couple of more personal questions. So the first question I have for you is, you know, what is one of your hobbies or pursuits unrelated to medicine? Can you tell us about what you like to do in your spare time?
I have a lot. Actually, maybe I should say I had a lot of hobbies. I like so many things. But after I started residency, a lot of them I had to give up.
I think that's a common theme.
That's a common theme. You're right. So now the thing I kind of keep up is ski, because my family, we all go ski.
Oh, wow.
Patient. So that's something I, you know, kind of keep up. But otherwise, I, you know, just no time to do anything else.
Ski, look after your kids. Well, skiing is a great hobby. Unfortunately, in Rochester, things are a little bit flat here. So I don't know, you might have to do the cross-country skiing. Well, good luck with that. I don't know. Have you tried that yet?
Yeah, I started with cross-country, actually. But now I like downhill more. We always go to Colorado in wintertime.
Ooh, beautiful. Okay, right. So it's proper mountains in Colorado. That's good. And then another quick question for you. What would you say is the most important book or movie that has affected your thinking in recent years, just about life or in general?
So the book I like most or affect me most for my career is, I think it's the Bible book we all read, right? So is The Emperor of All Maladies.
Yes, it's a great book.
It's a biography of cancer. I got the first copy as a requirement book during my fellowship. So we all had to read. And then later I bought an actual copy for myself so I can travel with it and get one for my son. I want him to read. It's such a great book.
It's a wonderful book. I got a gift of it before I moved to the United States, as I did my fellowship in the NCI. So I agree. It's a wonderful book, isn't it?
Yes. I think we're all required to read. We should. And a movie I want to talk about that's also kind of keep me going. The movie is called Awakening. It's an old movie. I saw the movie actually in recent years during COVID, you know, you cannot do anything else. So.
Might as well watch a movie.
So I saw that movie. The actor, I forgot his name, but he's really one of the greatest actors. So he played a doctor, neurologist. He was in a kind of facility for people with a mental problem. There was one patient, actually there were a group patient, they couldn't move their body, they couldn't have any expression. So he wanted to figure out why. He spent all his spare time looking for, you know, read all the literatures, check on them, looking for cause, looking for treatment. So he found, actually, I forgot the name what he used. He found some treatment. So he really kind of got those patients back to real life for a shorter time. Later, the patient kind of go back to, like, fall back to their stage, couldn't move again. But just the way how he worked, his dedication, his persistence, and his devotion to those patients really inspires me.
Sometimes, you know, you watch a film and it kind of resonates with you in a way, right? You kind of can really relate to the characters, and always good to watch an inspiring movie. Dr. Campion, I'm just so glad that you're here with us in Mayo and that you're leading all these wonderful efforts with the ACRU. We're so lucky to have your expertise as it relates to CNS tumors. And I know through the ACRU, you're going to do even more great things. So thank you so much for this wonderful interview. And thanks to you, our listeners.